Brother Flanagan became a BYU faculty member in 1993, and along with his administrative responsibilities, still continues to mentor PhD students in computer science. He's published numerous technical papers, acquired significant external research funding, and has won several awards.
Well, good afternoon. Thanks for having me here today. I'm excited about this opportunity to talk with you about some things that I rather enjoy doing. Brother Miller shared with me this flyer that's evidently been hung around campus, and I think it's kind of intuitive maybe here. We're competing for dummies, and there's a picture of a Mac. So if you're a Mac user, I'm not sure if you should take offense or not, but being a Mac user, I wasn't offended. So the Mac seems to get my work done for me. So anyhow, so I entitled the talk today, Computing for Dummies and the Rest of Us, for a couple of reasons. One is I think if you think of the series of books that were published that you might have seen or used, the yellow books with the black kind of band and the title X for Dummies, where X is virtually any topic you can imagine, essentially those books were written not for people that we think are dumb, but really for people who are less initiated in a particular field or discipline. So for that reason, I think the other thought is almost all of us believe we're an exception to that rule, right? So when we pick up the X for Dummies book at the bookstore, we don't really believe we're one of the dummies. We just think we want to read it so that we can become knowledgeable enough to converse with somebody who likely isn't, and we don't want to feel stupid. I also thought that it was a little bit provocative in the sense that it might actually get you to talk or come, and that's probably the last time I'll refer to that title, which has almost nothing to do with my talk. No, I'm only kidding. Okay. All right, so let me make a couple of observations and then maybe just a brief outline of my talk today. So the first observation I would make is that computing is available to nearly everyone, and I would include even those who don't know they have computing in their lives, right? So and this is really due to two different aspects. Computational devices can be found in nearly anything you can imagine. I challenge you at some point, if you'd like to take this challenge, is go to a web browser, open Google, and type X space computer and hit return, and just replace X with anything you can imagine. Okay. I did this just the other day. You can type in clothing and hit space computer and hit enter, and you will find that there are whole research teams working on how to put computational devices in clothing. Okay. There are conductive fabrics, it turns out. There are fabrics where people have woven in wires so that they can interconnect computational devices in different parts of your clothing. There was a computerized tennis shoe, which actually has a Wi-Fi connection as well as a cell phone connection, so that evidently you can keep track of your jogging while you're out doing it without keeping track of your jogging, I guess. I suspect that would be useful for almost anything other than church basketball, which it probably couldn't survive. So, the second aspect of that is that general purpose computing and what we think of as desktops and laptops and netbooks today are really available for very inexpensive prices, available for nearly everyone that can imagine wanting or desiring to own one. If you go to a well-known website, a manufacturer and distributor of computing equipment, I went there the other day and found that you can essentially buy their least expensive desktop computer without a monitor today for about $250. Now, that isn't a stellar machine. Most of you, particularly any computer or engineering students, would say, well, that machine's not going to make it for me. Just keep in mind that that probably would have been a supercomputer in like the 1960s. So what might not seem like a really valuable thing is actually quite astounding. So the rest of my talk, I really want to talk about how and why this happened, what makes it possible, and then to talk about what might be next. And then I'll just draw a few more observations and draw some conclusions. And then certainly it sounds like we can have questions and answers, which maybe we should just skip right to that and we'd all be happier. But so, Amdahl's Law. I want to start with a few laws. And before I go to Amdahl's Law, let me tell you about Murphy's Law, because that one impacts all of you. Okay, and it impacts everybody at the most inopportune times by definition. So as you might imagine, I've been thinking about this talk for some time, and frankly worrying about it for some time. And one of my responsibilities at BYU is to keep track of the podiums and the teleprompters and the TV and all of those kind of things surrounding devotionals and forums. So Tuesday morning, I get a call by the person who directs that effort at the devotional, and our devotionals are held in the Marriott Center, quite a large group of people, and we have a speaker for the day, fortunately, who came out of our own faculty, and I'll show you why that was fortunate in a minute. But having sitting there on the stand worrying about this talk coming up on Thursday, Murphy's Law struck. So the podium breaks right before the devotional, and it's stuck in its very lowest setting. Okay, so we have now a podium about this high in the Marriott Center, where most people view it from up in the stands, right? And we have the person conducting is about 5'10 or 5'11. And of course, we had that day the faculty member who is 6'6 giving the talk. Okay. So, you know, couldn't have been the shortest person on campus, had to be one of the tallest. And so that's Murphy's Law in action, right? That what you can imagine happening will, and it usually is used in a sarcastic sense of not being a good thing. So hopefully Murphy's Law won't strike today. So Amdahl's Law. I want to discuss laws, in a sense, what I think of engineering or scientific laws, in a sense, because when I was asked to give this talk, I asked for a little direction. And the direction was, well, talk about your profession. And we don't want to be over-dictate what you talk about, but talk about your profession. So I thought, well, out loud to myself, are you talking about my profession as an engineer, or the time I spent at Intel, or the time I spent as a computer science faculty member, or the time I've spent as a vice president and CIO, which on the surface seemed quite diverse, right? As an electrical engineer, I only cared about software enough to run the piece of hardware that I built, right? As a computer scientist, I was really interested in kind of the underlying pinnings of various programming languages and techniques to help computer scientists develop large bodies of code. And frankly, as the CIO, I've been very interested and in fact charged with making sure that software development works on campus as well as other kinds of technology. So I wanted to talk about something that essentially covers the gamut of those disciplines. So what things have applied in my life that I found have helped across all of those disciplines? So we're going to talk a little about a few laws. The first of all is Amdahl's Law. Amdahl's Law was named after Gene Amdahl, who was a famous computer architect. And it essentially says, how much speed up will you get out of a system by improving some subset or some component of the system which is used some percentage of its time? Algebraically, that looks like this equation that you see up on the board, which is speed up equals 1 over the quantity of 1 minus p plus p over s, where speed up is the overall speed up of the system. So how long does it take to accomplish the entire task, given the fact that some subcomponent is used p percentage of time, and s is how much you think you can speed that particular component up. Okay. Now, the next slide, I have an example of this that might help to clarify this a little bit. And that is imagine you have a game computer. And I use this because I suspect that some of the students might actually know what computer games are, right? Okay. Hopefully you don't spend too much of your time doing them, or else Amdahl's Law will apply to your life as well as this example. Okay. So the idea is that if you had a computer game for which 30% of the time spent, so let's say we played it for an hour, and 30% of the time is spent rendering graphics on the game, and the computer spends 70% of its time pursuing other activities, other kinds of arithmetic and logic operations, etc. Well, all of a sudden you find that the computer engineering students in BYU-Idaho have developed this new graphics card which speeds up graphics rendering 10x. Okay, so you get a 10x performance increase. By the way, if you do that, start a company and be happy ever after. But if you get this 10x speed up, how much will that really increase the performance of the overall system? How much shorter will your game necessarily be? And that's really the question to be asked. So if you plug those numbers, 30% and 10x, into the previous equation, which I've done here on the right, you can follow down that algebra there and realize that what you end up with is a speed up of about 1.37, which sounds relatively modest, and in fact is. That would be, by the way, a stellar kind of performance increase in the computer industry today, right? Because we've kind of leveled off on the performance increases over time. But probably not what you kind of expected. Now, clearly, Amdahl's Law in the extremes, if graphics rendering were the only thing you were doing, you would get a 10x speed up. If it was something you never do, you wouldn't get any speed up at all, right? So this isn't going to help you very much when you're doing Quicken or some other kind of activity, okay? So Amdahl's law can be probably easiest or more easily understood looking at the little graph at the bottom, the little bar chart where time moves from the left to right. And you imagine that the orange bar is the part that you think you can speed up, the yellow bar representing the piece that you can't really touch with this particular improvement. We shorten the little orange bar by 10x. We make it 1/10 the size because that's the component we're doing. And now you see that the overall length of the total time bar isn't really that much shorter. That's probably the best graphical way to interpret Amdahl's law. Okay, now the first thing you should learn from Amdahl's law, and this is probably applicable both at work and at home, is the sense that when you want to justify the purchase of a device, only mention S. Okay? So it's really great if you say, I really want to buy this graphics card, it costs $300, and it goes 10 times faster than before, right? That sounds impressive. If you tell your spouse that you want a new graphics card and it's going to increase the performance just by, 25 or 30%, probably not going to be a good sell, okay? Might not motivate them to buy it for you for Christmas, etc., okay? So from a business perspective, so if you look at Amdahl's law, I mentioned that I wanted to apply these laws across the various disciplines. From an engineering perspective, computer science perspective, we've described Amdahl's law as it's applied in those fields. If you think of it as a business perspective, it looks a lot like the law of diminishing returns, and in fact, in a special case, is identical, right? So if we took the graphics component that we used in our example, if that were the largest single component of time consumption was graphics and we improved it, and then we were to choose the next largest time-consuming component and we improved it, and we did that down the line, you would in fact experience the law of diminishing returns on your investment. The more you put in, the less in return you're going to get until it just isn't feasible to speed things up any longer. Okay? In a leader's perspective, when you're in a leadership position where you're really not talking about the management or development of anything necessarily, but you're really looking at what should I focus on, Amdahl's law really says to you, focus on big, important problems, right? Good advice for PhD students. Find big problems that are important, because if you can find improvements to big problems, they impact lots of people or they impact a few people in a really big way. If you find solutions to unimportant problems, no one else cares, right? I was once at a technical conference where somebody gave this talk for like 30 minutes about this particular component of a microprocessor that they had found a new way to create. And they had found an astonishing 50% improvement in performance. So people were pretty excited to go to this talk. People listened to the talk. And I can remember this older, distinguished gentleman got up, walked up to the microphone, and said, "Can you share with us what percentage of time traditional computing uses that portion of a microprocessor?" And for the poor speaker, the answer was, "We haven't been able to find a benchmark that utilizes that particular component." Okay? So what he said was, "Is we found a 50% improvement to a component that is never used by anyone." Okay? Okay. So not a very valuable problem to work on. Okay? Okay. Let's move on to the next law. And you've all heard of this law, and you've probably all misused it. It's Moore's Law. Okay, and Moore's Law is named after Gordon Moore, who was a co-founder of Intel Corporation. And in talking to an Intel employee that I know well, he shared a story about Gordon Moore, which kind of describes to you the kind of humble person Gordon Moore is. Gordon Moore, as you might imagine, Intel had an ATM machine in their lobby at some point, where they could, you could draw money out for the cafeteria or whatever. But, a lot of the employees would essentially take their dividend checks or their bonuses for the year or other kinds of checks like that, and they'd fill it out instead of carrying it around, and they'd deposit it through the ATM machine. Well, Gordon Moore gets his dividend check, right, probably in the order of like $2 or $3 million, right, takes it to the ATM machine, signs it, fills out the envelope, puts it in the envelope, stuffs it in the ATM machine, and then types on the little keypad that he's depositing a check for $3 million. And is shocked that it won't work, right? So evidently the bank didn't want to entrust a $3 million check in an ATM machine. But it was Gordon Moore's expectation that, well, why doesn't this work? That's a stupid thing. And I think that's the kind of mentality that Gordon Moore shared throughout his life about why doesn't technology do what I want it to do? Seems simple enough. So that's the kind of person Gordon Moore was. But His law really is stated that he states it as every year we will be able to put twice as many electronic components on a particular or a certain size area of silicon each year inexpensively. Now, there's some really key things here. First of all, he didn't say anything about performance, and I think that's my last bullet on this slide, but we'll jump ahead. He didn't say anything about performance, and he didn't say anything about lots of things that Moore's law is attributed to. Okay, and we'll talk about the fact that Moore's law impacts all of those things that we're used to, but he didn't specifically say anything about them. So the idea here is that Moore explained that every year I will be able to put twice as many transistors in the same area, right? So you pick the area, I can put twice as many transistors there every single year. Well, that's really probably lengthened out in the last few decades to be every 18 to 24 months, roughly, probably somewhere in between there. And again, doesn't specifically address performance. So let me apply now maybe a little bit of these together. So computer architects essentially then, by Moore's law, are given twice as many electronic components every 18 months to 24 months. Okay, I'm probably say 18 months over and over, so we'll just use 18 months, but it is certainly a range. The question is what do you do with them? So clearly some strategic direction was given to architects, computer architects, to say, we want you to increase the performance of these microprocessors so that computers in general can go faster. So using Amdahl's law, they were then left to say, we're going to find out the portions of the microprocessor or the computer in general that are slow, and we're going to figure out ways to throw more transistors at that problem to make that portion faster. Right? That's really the absolute strategic direction that those individuals took. Now, there's lots of other directions they could have went in. They could have said things like, we just want to make computers extremely small. We don't care how fast they go. We don't care how much they cost. We just want to make them small. And so we're going to use Moore's law to just keep making them smaller and smaller. I was once talking to a gentleman who worked for a cell phone manufacturer, and I asked, so why don't cell phones follow Moore's law in terms of size? And his first comment was, well, we considered that, but from a product perspective, you don't want people to choke on them, right? So evidently, it's important to make your cell phone large enough to keep it out of the average person's mouth, I suppose, okay? So there's some product, obviously there's some product drivers here as well, right? So I don't want to look past the fact that there are business forces almost always behind various engineering decisions, and we'll talk a little bit about those. But so you can imagine these architects given more and more transistors to use every year and being essentially tasked with the problem of find the next thing that's taking the most amount of time, apply these transistors to that, and make it go faster. And it's important to remember, too, that Moore talked about affordability or inexpensively place these transistors on the devices, because clearly you can spend an enormous amount of money and make an exception to Moore's law, right? You can find some way to make the wafer bigger. You can do things like that, but they aren't repeatable, okay? So I'm going to use Intel as an example here because I know the most about them, but certainly other manufacturers followed very similar, if not identical, paths. So way back when, practically when the dinosaurs walked on the earth, there was the 8086 processor, okay? And the transition from the 8086 to the 8286 to the 8386, just curiosity, anybody ever own one of these kind of machines? I have, but none of the students even know what I'm talking about, okay? So your cell phone has far more power than any of these processors, okay? These processors probably weren't capable of text messaging if it existed then. So these processors, really, all of the transistors were then expended by these architects to move these architectures from what I would think of as a toy architecture of 16-bit word widths to 32-bit words, and actually use some of them to increase the effectiveness of things like protected mode that would enable them to run real operating systems like Linux or FreeBSD or Unix or protected mode Windows, etc. Okay, so that's where the transistors went. The architects applied essentially Amdahl's law and said, this is where I'm going to put my effort. All right, so from the 386 to the 486, a different kind of transition occurred. So for those of you who owned 386s, you may remember that they weren't very good at floating point numbers because they only had integer arithmetic and logic units internal to the microprocessor. And so we thought we were really excited when we had enough money to go buy the 8387 coprocessor, which did floating point work, and it populated a separate socket on the motherboard. Okay, a very expensive way to do floating point, it turns out. And in fact, there were competitive chips that other companies sold, like Witek, which did floating point faster than the Intel version. And if you had a lot of money, you could buy one of those. So again, the architects applied Amdahl's law and said, listen, we've got so many transistors now, we believe we could take the floating point unit that's out in the 487 and or 387 and put it in the same chip as the microprocessor, and hence was born the 8486. Now, one other thing happened in this little time that's very subtle. This was back in the days when it was a war between RISC, reduced instruction set computers, and CISC, complex instruction set computers. The RISC world was all about every instruction runs in one single cycle, regardless of what it is. And we will emulate any other more complex operations. Where the CISC camp was, we're going to make really complex instructions to reduce the semantic gap between programming languages and what the machine understands. So if we can reduce that gap, then programs are easier to write. So that was kind of the ongoing war, and literally a war of words, because the press of the day, the technical journals of the day, were all about which is right. Okay. Now, it turns out neither of them were right. Intel was right, and that's because of business forces, for which they are essentially the only microprocessor manufacturer left, right? So they won, and it has nothing to do with CISC versus RISC or any of the other questions. It has to do with he with the most money can build the most fab plants, who can build the most chips for the least amount of money, right? And I suspect, and I suspect others like AMD essentially are there because that helps Intel avoid antitrust suits, right? So that's probably why they're there. Okay, hope I don't get in trouble for any of this. So that's okay. Your legal department should have cleared me, I guess. So the transition then from the 486 to the Pentium, and then to the Pentium Pro and the P2 and the P3 and the P4, we're actually now getting into a series of microprocessors for which even some of the students may have heard about. Essentially, that was all about, okay, now that we've solved those other problems, how do we use more transistors to increase performance even further? Well, essentially what we do is add more instruction execution units to the processor. In the Pentium, we did that. We added more execution units so we could do two adds at a time, or we could do two an add and a subtract at the same time, or a multiply and an add. Now, in the Pentium, these pipelines, these execution units weren't capable of doing the same work. One of them was actually capable of doing more work than the other, a different kind of a subset. But they were able to do more than one thing at a time. And then it was up to the compiler or the user to be able to line up instructions that weren't dependent on one another to enable that to happen. So if you wrote really bad code, you got no speed up at all. If you wrote really good code, you got some speed up. In the Pentium Pro, the P2, the P3, and the P4, we really then started allowing really complex things to start happening, which is out-of-order execution. And this happened across the markets in the IBM processors, the Hewlett-Packard processors. Everybody was doing this, essentially doing very complex stuff to allow instructions to be executed in the wrong order as long as they weren't dependent on each other. And then we unwind it to make sure it all ends up in the right order at the very last moment. Okay. So, and today, you are likely all aware that now we are throwing transistors at a different problem. So essentially, and this is an interesting side note, from the 8086 to the P4, essentially, to the Pentium Pro, we weren't inventing anything new, right? We were just sharing from the 1960s and 70s. We essentially just went and looked at IBM processors and said, we really like the IBM 360. Look, it does out-of-order execution. We should do that too. And the idea is that the technology allowed us to essentially suck everything that was developed in the last three decades and squeeze it down onto a little integrated circuit, which allowed us to sell it for, you know, sub $1,000. So, unfortunately, that creativity hasn't continued in the sense that now what we're doing is saying there is no single component left on a uniprocessor, single processor, microprocessor to throw more transistors at. So instead, we're just going to throw more processors on the same chip. So now we have dual-core processors and four-core processors. I think I've heard AMD's got a three-core processor. And we will probably see that continue on, where we are just adding more and more processors. So that's kind of where we've headed there. Now let me show you this graphically, because it's astounding. This whole thing is astounding when you think of the numbers. So this graph basically goes from 1971, which is the introduction of the Intel 4004, which is like a 4-bit or little tiny microcontroller that isn't even capable of running your most modest microwave oven today.
Right.
And I'm sure they found uses for it in 1971. I didn't care because I was like in elementary school or something. Okay. So, which the rest of you are going, and I wasn't even born yet. Okay. Or my dad wasn't born yet. I don't know. So don't. It's unfortunate that we get old. So if you look at this line, don't be confused by the line. It's an exponential growth, because if you notice, the y-axis is logarithmic, right? So look at the size of the numbers at the top of the y-axis. So think about in 1971 or 1972 or 3, the architect was told, you know, the last time we let you build a chip, it had 2,300 transistors on it. Today, we're going to give you a whopping 4,500 or 4,600 transistors, okay? And the architect scratches his head for like 30 seconds and said, okay, I know right where to use those, okay? Think of the poor architect today. He comes in and he says, okay, Joe, I've got an extra billion transistors for you. I hope you have a good use for them, right? And think of the amazing complexity of even interconnecting a billion components together in the right way to make one of these work. Okay? And it's amazing how an Intel or an HP or an AMD or others can just repeatedly deliver microprocessors of higher performance that actually function. And we do find a few flaws here and there, but very few, right? Okay. Astounding data is what I think this graph is very representative of. Now, I've put some arrows on there to point to kind of significant points related to the previous slide of the introduction of various processors. I think the most interesting part for me is that during my lifetime, essentially, my professional career being interested in computing is the central part where such significant architectural change happened. The place where architects had to make some really tough decisions. Okay, and for those that you may have a career in this field someday, my time at Intel was always the architects would design something or decide on something. The design engineers would implement it. We'd take all of these modules and literally tape them up on the wall, and then we would all notice that it's 10% too big to fit on the chip. Okay, that's bad, right? And so at Intel, we called these die diets. Okay, so we had to put the die on a diet to make it fit. And then the architects were left with the daunting challenge of, okay, tell me which 10% I can take off while minimizing the hit on performance. In other words, they had to kind of apply Amdahl's law backwards, right? And so pretty tough things we asked them to do. And imagine what that means today is, okay, that 10% diet, that's only 100 million transistors, right? So please do away with 100 million transistors that won't impact the circuit, okay? Not easy. Okay, so other related things to Moore's law, but aren't really what Moore said, right, is increased density of memory components. So I think Moore was particularly talking about microprocessor design, where the fabrication techniques and technology is different than memory design, although very, very similar, obviously. But the density of memory has increased significantly, so we get DIMMs now with very large capacities. You have storage devices. If you think about hard disk drives, and I'll share some information about hard disk drives with you in a few minutes, and finally you think about things like power density. One of the problems is if you take this to the ultimate. So imagine they would have chosen to do smaller instead of faster. Okay, so imagine way back in the 8086 days, they said, you know, we're not going to build an 8286. We're just going to build the 8086, and we're going to make it half the size that it was last time. And we're just going to keep doing that all the way out to where we are today, so that the 8086 is like, you know, this thing the size of a head of a pin, right? And realizing that every time you make it smaller, you can crank the clock up, right? So today, rather than having like a 3 gigahertz Intel i7-based laptop, right, you probably wouldn't get a laptop desktop. Imagine you had a, you know, 50 gigahertz Intel 8086, right? And the question is, why would have that been a bad design path? Because it might have worked, right? In fact, maybe you would get as good a performance out of that than all the complexity that we added. So the reason why you wouldn't want to do that, because the power consumption of that device would probably land somewhere around like the sun, right? So you'd have this little processor in your box about the size of a pea, right? And it would be burning like 10 kilowatts, okay? And the question is, how do you cool it, okay? So you don't put it in a laptop, right? That could be hazardous to your health, right? And no data center that I know that I'm aware of could possibly cool that kind of density. So imagine a rack of these things, right? So you have, you know, 500 processors in a rack. You've only got to cool 5 megawatts out of, in one rack. So that's one of the reasons why that design path likely didn't occur, because as the clock rate would increase, the power consumption would go up. So you just can't do some design paths. Okay, so let's do Moore's Law backwards. I think you'll find this illustrative, and it's kind of funny. We had a faculty member at BYU named Gordon Stokes, who, when he retired, when I just about, I don't know, I was in the department a couple of years, him and I got to know each other quite well, very nice gentleman. He retired, and he had done some consulting in his life, and one of the jobs that he had for consultants was to help the state of Idaho choose a computer for the nuclear test facility, okay? Or nuclear something facility, you probably all know. I don't know. Okay, so I in my possession have this little pamphlet or little book for which he produced in 1964, which is, you know, for me it's kind of funny because it's actually typed, and I can't remember if I've ever typed anything in my life. So, you know, I type on a keyboard and print, but believe it or not, people that went before us actually used these things called typewriters, and if you haven't seen one, you can probably find a museum or something that has one in it, okay? There's probably still some on campus for doing multicolored forms, is my guess. Somebody somewhere has one on campus, so I couldn't believe that they don't. Okay, so this is a 1964 computer, okay? And I think this will kind of blow you away here, okay? This is not a 32-bit or a 64-bit machine like we're talking about today. This had a 24-bit word, okay? This computer would be something I think you could probably have as a senior class in a computer engineering program to say, we want you to build one of these, okay? And remember, this was like the computer of its era, okay? It didn't run at 3 gigahertz or 1 gigahertz or even in the megahertz. This thing ran at 167 kilohertz, okay? That's almost in the audio range, right? You get a little lower, you could hear it run, right? Okay? I can hear that it just got to my for loop, right? That's good, okay? Okay. This thing had not 2 terabyte hard disk drive, which is what we get today that we can hold in our hands, right? Not a terabyte or a gigabyte. It had a 7 megabyte hard disk drive. And I tell you, this hard disk drive is as large as this podium, right? And in the late 70s, early 80s, we used to refer to those things as washing machines because they shook like washing machines and they made lots of noise, right? They're huge, okay? Now, this thing didn't have gigabytes of memory. It had 64 kilobytes of memory, okay? Any guess to what it cost? Just a mere $420,000, right? And it would likely take up a very large room. Now, the one statistic that really blew me away is it doesn't come with a hard disk drive for $420,000. That's a mere $53,000 add-on, okay, for 7 megabytes, okay? I don't know what you paid for your little memory stick, but my little memory stick here, which is, you know, roughly, well, let's see, 1,000 times would be 7 gigabytes, so it's, you know, roughly, I don't know, 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 times bigger, cost me like $100 probably at one point, right? So amazing difference. So that's kind of Moore's Law and back. So if you look back to 1964 and you think of that straight line, which is really exponential, what Moore's Law has enabled us to do in the last, 45 years is pretty significant. Right, that's the kind of computing that back then was state of the art, okay, and hard to believe. Okay, so the financial impact of that, we dealt with that a little bit. So in the I wanted to go back to my own history. In the early 80s, we bought our first PC. Linda and I were married. We lived in student housing at BYU. My mom and dad had to loan us the money to buy this thing because it was such an enormous investment, right? $2,000, and it was an 8 megahertz 8086 with a megabyte of memory and a 20 megabyte hard drive. And it was faster than any machine in any of the labs at BYU, and we thought we died and went to heaven, okay? And it even had a color display. It actually let you use magenta, cyan, yellow, and black. It was awesome. Okay, today, you go on a website. I go to a four-letter named provider of computing systems, and the fastest machine I can find there with kind of its standard configuration is $2,000. And this thing's a 2.66 gigahertz i7 with 6 gigabytes of RAM and a terabyte of disk space, okay, for the same price. So you think about the the impact that could have and what people can accomplish. Now, check this out. So in 1964, the 7-megabyte hard disk drive cost $53,000, which by my math is $7,571 per megabyte. I just recently bought a 2-terabyte hard disk drive, and I actually didn't pay $350. I actually paid $330 from Amazon with shipping.
Okay,
that's $0.0002 per megabyte. Now, if I don't take into account inflation, so I just take it that $53,000 in 1964 is the same as $53,000 today, which I think is probably pretty ludicrous. $53,000 in 1964 probably could actually buy you something. Certainly, we bought our first house in 1989 for like $58,000, so you could buy a house. I mean, I don't know. I do actually know this. My mother and father bought a 3,500-square-foot, 5-bedroom house in Southern California, no less, in 1964 for $28,000. Okay, so you could have two of those houses or this hard disk drive. You could pick. Okay, I'm not sure which would be smaller, actually. Okay, but if you look at that, that $53,000 today would buy you 302 terabytes of storage, which is 43 million times more than it was in 1964. Okay, I think that's pretty astounding. Okay, so what's up in the next 10 years? Okay, well, first of all, I have no idea really. But second of all, let's just conjecture. So let's say you pick a middle-of-the-road PC. This is actually the amount of money that we believe at BYU, the average kind of access across the campus from researchers to single desktop computers on campus is about $1,300. So that $1,300 computer in 10 years might have 256 processors in it. That'd be pretty neat. That'd be 1/10 of the current BYU supercomputer, by the way. So I'm guessing you're not going to get 1/10 of the staff to run the supercomputer for everybody's desktop either, but that's a good try. That's something we would try in academia, right? We need more staff to keep care of my desktop. Okay, and it might have 64 terabytes of storage in your little desktop, and that would be enough to store all of the current university data at BYU. I suspect at BYU-Idaho as well. So imagine that everybody's desktop could have all of the data on it all of the time. Right? What would you do with the data? Well, you better have a good search engine because you're likely not going to find what you want anytime soon. Right? So you'd have to have Google on your desktop, I guess, right? Okay, your laptop might have 128 processors and 25 terabytes of storage. And I think that comes home to how amazing that is when you realize that it could store 7.5 times the number of books in the Harold Bealey Library. If you've been to that library, I mean, it's 5 stories and a lot of space. So you put 7.5 of those kind of libraries on your laptop at your command anytime you like them. Okay. Now, I like the best one. I think the iPod with 5 terabytes of storage, enough to listen to continuously for 44 years is pretty cool, right? You plug this thing in when you start your career, and it just plays music in your office until the day you retire and then well beyond, right? Okay. Now, the one market force might tell you, well, that's ludicrous. That's never going to happen. Nobody wants 44 years of music on their iPod. Probably true, right? I can't even imagine putting all of that in iTunes, but imagine putting that on your iPod. But what is more likely is that you're going to want video, right? And when my son, now who just had a baby a year ago, takes video of their daughter with their HD camcorder and then sends those files to my server in my basement, they're 1 gigabyte per minute of video, right? So a 17-minute videotaping of a birthday party is 17 gigabytes of data, okay? So you can imagine with that kind of video, you can imagine this being chewed up pretty quickly. So it may actually happen. Now, the question is, can this continue? Well, I would say not really, because at some point, as you make these devices smaller and smaller, pretty soon they're the size of an atom. And we currently don't know how to safely break that atom up in pieces and then use those to build devices out of. Now, maybe there's some physicists here or chemists that know something I don't know, but I don't think it's at least marketable production capable yet. A single processor gains have likely already come to a halt. In fact, the admission that's given by the product developments at Intel and other places show us that since they're developing 2-core and 4-core processors, kind of by default, they're deciding there's nothing to be gained more in the single processor arena. Now, Moore's Law has essentially ushered in Core's Law, so what we will see is just more and more of these cores on a single chip, right? And we'll just see more and more of that. But if you remember back to Amdahl's law, what that tells you is we won't see any performance gains unless there's parallelism in your application. So if you can't exploit the parallelism, the more cores aren't going to do you any good. What it means is when you're running Quicken, one of your processors is going to be used and the other 4, 5, 8, 16 are just going to be sitting there idle, right? Now, fortunately, people like video gamers, they know how to do this because they know they can render on multiple processors, so any video encoding or any of those kind of things. So there are lots of applications that can take advantage of this parallelism. And in fact, an interesting experiment is what I like to call time travel with money. So if you want to develop an application for these kinds of machines of the future, what you ought to be doing is developing those applications for a clustered supercomputer like at BYU, because that will be what's on your desktop in another 5 to 10 years. Okay, so now what do we care about all of this? So this is why I think we care. So this graph has a lot of stuff on it, but let me just share. The slope that slopes from left to right downwards, that's really the expertise that is needed to use computers. Okay, the reflection of that over the y-axis, essentially sloping up towards the end, is Moore's law, saying we can put more and more devices to use each and every year. The boxes are essentially saying what we can do with those. So on the left-hand side, we have, the initial computers, they weren't very sophisticated. We had to program them in machine code, so we had to understand the very organization of the machine. We had to understand what, two's complement meant and signed integers and all kinds of things to code these things up. Well, as the performance of the machine increased, what that meant is that we could start building tools that would abstract away some of those details from us as the user. And I'm using user here pretty loosely because this is really the computer scientists, the computer engineers, the scientists and others who are so desperate to use these devices that they're willing to go through the pain of using them, right? Okay, as we move further to the right, you're right, as we move further that way, they become so powerful now, we can start introducing all kinds of tools which make them available to less educated in this disciplines that becomes available to them, right? The title for dummies, right? So these aren't dummies, these are smart people, but not particularly trained in this area. So as we move further and further, we can take advantage of the performance to increase the levels of abstraction, making them easier for people to use. I like this example, okay? A dishwasher, right? So you think about a dishwasher. It has a heating element in it. It has a valve that lets water in. It has a valve that lets water out, right? It has a pump. It has some kind of automated thing that can open up and let soap out, etc. So if by the application of a microprocessor in your dishwasher, you can abstract all of that away into a button that says wash, right? So you put soap in, close the door, and you wash it. Now, the men in the room may never get the dishes in the right way in the dishwasher. That's a given. But the dishwasher will do what it says it does if you push the button, right? Okay. Now, performance enhancements enable abstraction. So the programming, the way you program them can change. The program sizes have obviously grown over time. You think of things like Windows, right? That's a huge abstraction that takes away all the details. The HP 1000 computer that I first used in a course at BYU actually required you to know which sectors you were laying your data down on the hard disk when you wanted to save your file, right? So you didn't just say, you didn't just say file save, right? You said, I want to put my file on sectors 12, 13, 14, 15, and 18, right? So you had to know all those details. So we've abstracted all that away so that people don't have to know about those. In fact, my children don't know the difference between memory and disk space, right? They ask you, how much room does this computer have? Well, what do you mean by room, right? I always ask that question. They always look at me like, what, are you stupid? I just want to know how much room it has. So we've abstracted it so much away that the average user doesn't care or need to know, right? Their stuff either fits or it doesn't, right? And we've gone away to things like virtualization, cloud computing, web services, all of these things that you've likely all heard. But essentially, those are just taking advantage of the extreme performance that we have and abstracting away the details. Now, I just want to really quickly, give you some examples of what I think of as web services, where people are doing amazing computing without any knowledge of the underlying complexity that they're actually bringing into play. Okay, so 1-800-TravelBooking.com. Okay. These people wrote a really simple web page, and all it does is sucks up Google Maps, Google Spreadsheets, and Geocoder. And it basically says, okay, my spreadsheet has in it hotels and their prices and their availability. Google Maps can print me a map of, you know, whatever city I'm interested in, and I want to take the two, and I want to drop all of the hotels on the map where they are, from with the geocoder telling me precisely where those hotels are, and I want to drop them down there. So the builder of this company essentially just mashed these three different sources of information together without having to have done any of that detail, right? They just got it for free and sucked it up and built a company around it, right? They took advantage of that layer of abstraction. A Zillow iPhone application, same kind of a thing, except for it shows you home sales. If you download this on your iPhone on your drive home, you can see what all your neighbors' houses are worth, which one sold recently, how much they sold for, if they're up on the market, how much they're up on the market for, etc. Kind of amazing. They just suck from all kinds of public data, and you can learn more about your neighbors than you ever wanted to know. Okay, and then produces an iPhone application. Here's another one, lastminute.com. You want to travel tomorrow? Just go on there. They actually aggregate 13,600 sources of travel information. So imagine if they had to do the details of implementing those 13,600 services, but they don't. They just consume them. And the last one I want to talk about is TwitGraph, which essentially, if you know what Twitter is it goes through the Twitter timeline, looks for the topic that you're interested in, and then uses the Google tools to graph these and gives you it tries to do some natural language processing to decide whether that statement, that microblog, was positive, negative, or neutral, and then plots it on a graph for you. Here's an example for a week of I search for the word BYU, and you could see that some of the negative comments in red, but a lot of neutral and a lot of good things were said. And you can search for your name, you can search for BYU Idaho, anything you want to, you know, if you start a new company, you can look at this and see if, are people talking about me, right? Again, they didn't do anything really very impressive here other than consume Twitter, do some whatever processing they wanted to do on it, and then use somebody else's tool to graph it, and all of a sudden it's an online application available to anybody that wants to use it. Okay, so in closing, let me draw a couple of more observations and a little bit of a summary. So the effort your effort should be centered on problems that's solutions to problems that have significant impact. Don't waste your time focusing on small things. Performance increases have been used to abstract away detail. And it gives everybody the opportunity to use computing, right? It will become available to more and more people, okay? The latest I like really is the digital picture frames, right? You buy a picture frame, you set it up. The latest picture frame I played with that we gave to our son, actually, is it knows how to do RSS feeds from, like, Flickr, okay? So you just send this picture frame to them, and then you put pictures in Flickr, right? And they show up on the picture frame wherever they live, right? It's great for grandma, right? You send her pictures. You know, my mother, when she was alive, was always nagging us. Why haven't you sent me any pictures lately, right? I don't know how often I heard that. I got really tired of it. But I should have bought her one of these picture frames and got her a Flickr account, and she would have never known the difference other than new pictures show up on her table every day, right? Would have been great. Okay. I probably still would have heard from my mother. Okay. Moore's Law describes why we find computing everywhere, and that's because it's getting smaller, cheaper, and faster, right? We've got everything, essentially. Faster performance gains will facilitate more abstraction, which will simplify even more complex problems. So problems today that we think are complex and unavailable probably will be solved. And finally, I just think, you know, my career in computing, which started in my bedroom when I was 16 years old with a single board computer that I actually learned to solder on, my 30 years of computing have been enormously fun and exciting. And if you look at those exponential curves, that just means that the next 30 years or your careers will even be more fun. Thanks.